Welcome to Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. I am your host, Henrik Johansson. I am the CEO and one of the founders of Gemba. Gemba helps entrepreneurs and companies to turn their great ideas into awesome new consumer products. Please stay to the end of the podcast and you'll learn how you can be our next guest on Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. Let's do it. Welcome to Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. It's a podcast about successful product entrepreneurs and their journeys, how they got there. And not just focus on success, but also some of the hard learnings and obstacles they overcame in on the way there. And today we're super excited to have Travis Rosbach with us, the founder of Hydro Flask, which had a very successful exit a few years back. I think it was a 9-figure exit, and we'll talk a little more about that. And he's also been on a lot of podcasts, famous speaker, consultant to many successful other businesses. So without further ado, welcome, Travis. We're excited to have you.
Henrik, I am very appreciative to be here. Thank you very much. This is going to be fun.
Yeah, I look forward to it. I love these conversations. So before we get into all the business stuff, can you just give us a couple minutes on yourself? Where did you come from? Where did you go? Family, pets, what do you like outside of work?
Yeah. So I was originally from Salem, Oregon, and I met my dad when I was 14. He was living in, and he still lives, in St. Croix, the U.S. Virgin Islands. And I took off down there shortly after graduation. I graduated from South Salem High School and took off to the Virgin Islands. I became a dive master, a scuba dive instructor. Eventually, I got my boat captain's license. And one day, I realized that I wanted to fly for the Seabourn Airlines. And yeah. So took off and became an airline pilot, seaplane pilot, and then eventually left there and became a jet pilot and flied. I flew all over the country and all over the place doing jet charters. Wow. And that was a lot of fun. But I had a real passion for business. I grew up reading a lot of business books. I was fortunate enough to inherit a fairly large business book library with books.
I can see you have one behind you.
Yeah. I keep it going to this day. I keep it updated fairly regularly. And so I left the airlines and left the dive world behind and came back home to Oregon and started bend fencing, doing wooden fences, arbors and gazebos and things like that. And then I had a fairly decent exit from there and took off to Oahu and started Oahu Signs and Screen Printing, which was a lot of fun. It morphed from a sign shop into more of an agency type of vibe to it. And did that for a while and learned a lot and met a lot of wonderful people and really enjoyed my time in Hawaii. And then one day I was thirsty and couldn't find a water bottle that suited my needs and said, how hard could it be? And famous last words, started Hydro Flask.
That's amazing. So we'll get back to that in a minute. But before then, so it sounds like you always had the entrepreneurial spirit in your blood. Did you come from an entrepreneurial family? Was that part of your DNA growing up, or is that something you evolved on your own?
A little bit of both. My dad owns multiple dive shops in St. Croix, Cane Bay Dive Shop, and he's had anywhere from 1 to 4 or 5 dive shops at any given time. But that was always, I did not even know that about my dad. I was 12 when I started really getting into business. My next door neighbor died, and I inherited his bookshelf and all of his Brian Tracy books and Jim Rohn courses and seminars and all those types of wonderful media that I just dove right into and absorbed. And then by the time I met my dad and he was owning a dive shop, he would do something and I would say, hey man, that's not what Brian Tracy says to do. And he's Travis, this is the way we do it in St. Croix. I'm like, okay. Yeah. But then he would leave and he'd take off and leave me the keys, the money bag, and the shotgun. Wow. And I would try a couple different techniques that I'd picked up here or there and by golly, some of them would work and some of them he was right. And it does not work like that in St. Croix. And then my mom also owned a daycare in Salem. And so I got to watch her struggle with business. And I always thought if I owned a daycare, I would have done it this way or that way. And, you know, she had some wins and some losses, but it was always an inherent part of me, I would say.
Yeah. Wow. Thanks for sharing. That's an amazing story. I have a similar love for books. And I can remember distinctly, I was management consulting, sitting in a corporate department. I was reading The 7 Habits of Highly Successful People. And it was something that just blew my mind. It's like, what? Yeah. There's a gap between action and reaction. And that was my beginning of my journey of just, and I have bookshelves, not in the background, but it's so much you can learn from others.
I truly believe that. And nowadays with internet and even TikTok, I pick up some things here and there. And of course, YouTube has a plethora of knowledge if you can find it. But I find that there's really nothing that beats a good book. There's just, you really get, at least I myself, get really into a topic or a genre or an author. And I feel like I just get a lot more from the written word.
Yeah. Yeah. When I read books, they become littered with notes, underlined, dog ears. And I think that's what you probably don't get when you just listen. But there's a time to reflect and process and get takeaways. What does that mean for me?
Yeah. I say I paid $25 for it. I'm going to write in it. I'm going to take notes. I'm going to have a highlighter with me at all times. And I'm going to use it. And I'm going to come back and use it as a reference manual later on. And so that's what I really love about having my library is that if there's a question I have or a topic or a business genre that I need to be in or I'm moving into, I can just go grab the book that's on that topic. I can open it up. I can skim through the highlights. I can skim through my own thoughts, and my own notes, and I can be right back in it and pick up where I left off 20, 30 years later.
Yeah, that's so true. All right, so let's switch towards Hydro Flask. So you were running a screen printing business of promotional products type. So I guess you got exposure to some of the existing products in that space. Was that sort of what caused you to think of, come up with, I need something better than this?
The sign company started out, actually we did start out as a bit of a promotional product company in the very, very early days, and then found that the whole ASI and promotional product world was maybe going to be a little bit limited in scope compared to what we wanted to do with the sign company. So we had a fairly large printer and we made big banners and we picked up a screen printing machine and an embroidery machine. And then pretty soon that grew and we had a whole outsourced department of embroidery and we did large outdoor signs all over Oahu that we worked with another company doing the big billboard type bright light up signs that Honolulu County would allow us to do. And what was really cool is that we had a lot of surfers, a lot of surf companies. We had MMA was just becoming a thing. And it was just becoming a thing in Hawaii, in Oahu. And we were right there in the heart of it. And so we'd have the fighters would come in and their promoters would come in and we would sort of draft and grow and build these promotional campaigns. What's the logo look like? What are your colors? What is your tagline? And we took them from the mentality of being someone who gets in the octagon and fights to being more of a brand. And so we started growing these brands. And as we started growing these individual brands, we just everything grew. Like, how do you actually create a billboard and go from an idea to having it printed and having it put up on the highway? And it was a lot of fun. It was a great learning experience on how to brand and how to market and how to get yourself from not much to, wow, now people are showing up at your event, whether it be a fight or a surf competition or buying your product.
Yeah, that's awesome. So then what was the first step you took when you invented Hydro Flask? Did you have a very clear vision of what it was? Or can you talk a little bit about what was the sort of ideation to finish product, the very first product?
Yeah, so I went into a sporting goods shop downtown Honolulu, and I was thirsty. I was tired of having the single-use plastic bottles wash up on our beach every morning, and it was fun to clean up the beach every day. And then after a week or two, it became a bother. And then after about a month, it was pretty expensive to take all that and take it to recycle. And I knew I wanted to get a bottle that I could reuse and that wasn't just going to end up in a landfill or end up even worse in the ocean. And went into the sporting goods store to buy that bottle. And the whole shelf, the whole wall was completely empty. And I said, what happened? And they said, what's this stuff? We're not really sure what it is. The owner is European. She was in France last month and she heard about this stuff, BPA or whatever it is. And as a precautionary measure, she pulled all the plastic bottles. I was like, who's going to fill up the wall? Who's going to do that? And they said, Nobody. There's nobody else doing it. And Henrik, it came in the back of my head. It came out my mouth. I will do that.
I love that.
At that moment, I had a sort of a 10-year vision down the road where I was up on stage wearing a goofy jacket, standing up like a professor does in front of a large coliseum talking to people or auditorium, whatever they're called. And I knew it was going to be successful. And so that's how it originally started. And then after that, I kept having self-doubt and I kept thinking, no, I own a screen printing company. I have a sign shop. I don't do water bottles. That's not me. And every time I had that thought, somebody would come along and complain they didn't have a bottle, or I'd buy an aluminum bottle and it just sucked. The mouth was too small or it dented too easy. It had BPA in it also. The single wall metal bottles on the market were not keeping my hots hot and my colds cold. And so ended up in China and ended up getting a couple prototypes. And that's how it really started.
Wow. That's great. Just the audacity of seeing the opportunity immediately saying, I'm going to do that. I'm going to fill that shelf. That's awesome.
I don't know if it was audacity or stupidity or what it was, but it just came out. And I remember thinking, like, I don't lie. Why would I say that? Like, where did that even come from? Who said that?
Yeah.
And yet I knew, like, I have to do this now. Mm-hmm.
And then also the very real doubt afterwards that I think we all as entrepreneurs, which maybe people from the outside don't realize that, but there's a lot of doubt all the way and questioning it and feeling imposter syndrome and things like that. So thanks for sharing that. I think it's great. Okay, so you end up in China, you get a prototype. Now, presumably it's become time to make some real investment, right? You have to place a purchase order for this thing. You have to figure out how to sell it. You had already a successful business. So did you self-fund it at this stage?
We did originally, yes. Yeah, we had, so this was right around the 2008 crash, and Oahu was a little bit, Hawaii in general, was a little bit delayed in experiencing the financial crisis of 2008, 2009, because people had already booked their trips. And so money was still trickling in for a while, but the writing was on the wall. We could see down the road a ways and knew that everything that was happening on the mainland was eventually going to happen in Hawaii. So we had a bit of a fire sale. We sold a lot of the assets. We sold mopeds and our car. And I had a girlfriend at the time. And we sold our surfboards and everything we could to get the first minimum order quantity produced, the molds made and all of the marketing, everything, the packaging, everything that goes into having a product.
Right. So you started this from the existing business. What did you spin
up? We started it from a lot of the assets from it. Yes. Yeah. It was a lot more money than I think that we originally anticipated. So we took on a lot of credit card debt, and I already had a lot of aviation and student loans from college. And I thought, if I'm ever going to be able to pay off my student loans, it's going to be through having another business of my own that I can eventually pay it off. And so it was self-funded for the first six months to about 9 months, we self-funded it and then really started relying upon friends and family and mortgages and second mortgages and more credit cards.
Wow. Wow. So big commitment, taking a lot of risk.
It was. Yeah, it was. Yeah. Every time I remember signing the contracts for the new the second mortgage or helping a credit card, signing a credit card, it was terrifying. It was one of those things that I thought, if it doesn't work, I'll probably end up in jail for not paying off all these credit cards and student loans. Sally Mae's coming for me if I can't give her my money back.
Yeah. So let me guess, there was a lot of waking up at 3 a.m. and sweating and having a hard time falling back asleep. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a very well-worn spot at the top of the stairs where I'd sit and look out the window about 3 o'clock every morning. And especially later when we had employees. With employees and not knowing how we're going to make payroll and how are we going to buy lunch on Friday today's Thursday at 3 a.m. and we've got -$25 in the account. It was absolutely terrifying from the human aspect of the employees and everybody who had counted on us to get there. And the business side of things was ancillary, but the human side was absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. But then exhilarating too, in a way, right? It's that two-sided thing. It must have been, maybe you can share a little bit, like when did that first product get to your warehouse and who were your first customers? How did you, because this was pre-Amazon largely, right? So there wasn't, couldn't you just put up an FBA store and sell this stuff. You had to sell it yourself, right?
Yeah. The website was very much an afterthought. It took us about a year and a half to even have a functioning website because it just really wasn't that necessary. We were taking the bottles up to the Portland Saturday Market here in Portland, Oregon, and we'd set up a 10 by 10 booth. Originally, we started with the card table down by the railroad tracks, by the Max Railroad, and had a little card table with the table throw, and we both had our Hydro Flask t-shirts on and just hoping that people would try it. Just try it once, buy one, it's only $20 and lifetime warranty. If you don't like it, we'll be here next week. We promise we'll at least try to be here next week and we'll give you your $20 back. And we had, I don't remember anybody ever coming back and getting their money back, but they would start coming back and buying a second and a third and a fourth. And then pretty soon Christmas gifts and birthday gifts, and everybody in the whole family had one and they were picking out their own colors. And we moved from the railroad tracks into the Saturday Market. And then once we had a proper 10 by 10 pop-up tent, we felt pretty established at that point. And then eventually we picked up our first sales rep. And that sales rep took us to some of the local sporting goods stores, and I was able to get us into Whole Foods, which was incredible.
That must have been a big deal.
Oh, it was massive. It was one of those things that the first day that we actually had bottles here in Bend, Oregon, I walked in and eventually convinced them that we're not selling water. We're selling just the bottle, not water. Yes, we know that you sell water, but that's not us. It's just the bottle. Oh, okay. We went and met that guy and he said, yeah, Trav, I'll take some. And once we had that Whole Foods badge, we could take that all over town and say, hey, Whole Foods. And people would say, oh, okay, sign me up also, because they didn't want to be left in the dust because of this new giant that had just come into town. And then with the sales reps, we started getting more and more outdoor sporting good type stores and started going to more trade shows and picking up more and more reps. And it grew and grew.
Yeah. So was there a moment there where the focus shifted from selling to suddenly, holy crap, now we got to deliver? Because I assume that you were experiencing pretty rapid growth at that time, correct?
Oh, it was incredible. Yeah, it was the first, the first MOQ was 3,000. The minimum order quantity that they would sell us from the factory was 3,000, but we could only afford 1,500 at first. So we had 1,500 bottles in my grandparents' one car on one side of their garage, or their two-car garage. and then took the remainder over to my mom's and put it in her shed. And then when the next order, I think, was maybe 10,000, we got a warehouse. And then the next order was 20,000, and the next order was 40,000. And so we got another warehouse next door and blew the wall out. And we had 40,000 bottles in a 10,000 square foot warehouse. Then we needed the marketing people and the sales department and the graphic designers. And then this new thing called social media was just coming up, and this new thing called Amazon came up, and this new thing called you can sell it on the website. Oh, wow. How do we do that? You need a team. So pretty soon we were doing 40,000 a month. We started doing 80,000 a month. Eventually we're doing 120,000 bottles a month, and moved the what we now call the fulfillment facility up to Portland, and moved all of the laser engraving and things like that up to a separate warehouse facility a little closer to the docks.
And how quickly, what was the duration there from getting on the market or getting into Whole Foods to 100,000 bottles a month? Was that a year, 2 years?
It was about 2 years. Yeah, two and a half years. We were doing three shipping containers a month at 40,000 bottles of shipping container. And we'd have two come into our facility and another one would go out east, and it would get broken up amongst Dick's and Sportsman's Warehouse and the back east companies. And it was full tilt boogie at that point.
Yeah. So just doing rough math, like 100,000, over a million bottles a year at $20, plus you're doing 30 million, 40 million, something like that at this stage.
Yeah. In three years. Yeah. And, again, it's a lot of money to put out, though, to order it. The bottles are now, and they were back then, about $6 each from the factory. Mm-hmm. And so 120 times six, and we would have to pay the factory. And then after we paid the factory, it'd take 30 days to produce, another 30 days on the water, another 30 days to come in and get inventoried and rearranged and then shipped back out, another 30 days for them to arrive and get put in the system, and then another 30 days before we actually got paid. So there was a real long lag time between here you go to, oh God, thank you.
Yeah.
So, that was always terrifying.
So did you raise money at that point, or did you get bank loans? So how did you fund the inventory?
No, around 2009, 2010, 2011, we had a really hard time trying to find bank loans. There just wasn't a lot of banks who had ever heard of a water bottle company. And even what we have, PayPal, we used PayPal, and yet PayPal thought we were some sort of mafia money laundering type organization. And they withheld our money. And they said, nobody makes money this fast and nobody sells water bottles. You guys must be a scam. And so they even shut us off. And so luckily we started growing fans, and some of those fans would come in and say, hey, I've got $20,000 here, $100,000 here, and can we loan you some cash? And so that's how we started with the local market, just finding people who were just believers in the product and in the business. And that helped us get through up until we eventually got some VC funding.
Yeah, great. And it sounds like you had a really solid factory partner then, or did that evolve over time? Did you switch, or were you pretty much sticking with the same original factory all along?
No, it switched quite a few times, actually. There weren't very many factories at all in the world doing double wall vacuum insulated water bottles. And in fact, there was just a couple. And it was extremely difficult to convince them that they should use their vacuums to make water bottles. They were using them to make Japanese milk bottles, and they were making other little metal widgets and things, but not actually water bottles. They're a little bit of tea accessories, but nothing like what I was looking for. And So it was a lot of, I spent months and months, the first year especially, in China and just working and sleeping at the factories and as close as I could to the factories and eating in the factories and going to the local hospitals when I would get sick and going through the whole rigmarole of not only building the brand and the product and the business, but building the actual product and helping even build the machines to build the machines to build the machine to build the product. Yeah. And that was a long process. It was a work in process for the first at least 4 years, in progress, I should say, for the first 4 years. And we switched a number of times and kept growing and then eventually found the factories that could make the growler and the factories that can make the 12-ounce bottle and the ones that can make everything in between.
Yeah. Love hearing those stories because today there's so many, I don't know, people that want to get rich quick scheme, and there's plenty of gurus out there will tell you, I can help you build a $1 million business with no effort. And certainly folks like Amazon and Alibaba and others have made it easier. But if you're really trying to create something unique, something differentiated, I don't think there is a quick path to that, right? You have to go through what you went through. And a lot of other guests on the podcast have, you know, been talking about that you really invent something, it takes significant effort and commitment and perseverance.
I firmly believe you have to go there. You have to go to the factory in order to be really seriously in the game. And I can't tell you how many people I've met who found a product on one of the aforementioned websites, and it starts out great. And then after the third order, they're getting all these complaints. And why is this happening? The factory you thought you were buying the product from isn't actually the factory that's making it. You have no idea who's making your product or where it even is or who's paying whom for what. And it gets muddled. And the only way to overcome that is just to be boots on the ground and go in and sit down and drink tea and sit there with them and talk about, what are we doing here? Are we doing the right thing? Are we doing as much as we can? Are we doing more than we should? Is there more that we can do? And why is this like this? And why is that like that? And the first 4 years, I was in the thick of it doing just that.
Yeah. Did you have translators with you or did you learn to speak the language? Or?
Neither. No, just a lot of charades. And after spending a lot of time there, I just absorbed the language and I could understand what they were saying. And I could understand it might sound weird, but I could almost understand their, like, just the essence of what they were conveying and how I needed to convey what I wanted or what I did not want. And over the years, they started getting better and better at English, which was a massive help. And typically what happened is they started to recruit people out of college that were very fluent, or not, I can't say very, but they were quite fluent in English. And they may not know about the bottle industry, but they knew English. And so together, I would learn a little bit more Mandarin and they would learn more English, but together we would learn a lot about the bottle industry because I just was constantly asking more and more questions.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. So then let's talk, when did you start thinking about an exit? Was this something you had planned all along or was this inbound interest that came towards you? And can you tell us a little bit about that process?
Yeah, I hadn't any idea about an exit. I didn't have anything on my mind other than creating the best water bottle on the planet and giving it out to the most people. I just wanted people to be hydrated. I just wanted to hydrate the masses. And that was as far as my thinking went. I had no financial goals with it. I had no long-term goals, but I also didn't want to just do it short term. It was something that I was really invested in. And it was my life. It was who I became and who I was. And then after I had a few things, personal things that happened in my life. And I relate it to when I was flying airplanes, that I had a kind of a goals list of, I want to fly this plane and I want to fly that plane and I want to do this and I want to do that. And when I checked all those boxes and flew all those jets and flew a bomber and did all these different things, I became a glorified taxi driver up in the sky. And yeah. I got a little bit bored, a little bit antsy, a little bit like, okay, been there, done that, the season's over. Hydro Flask mm-hmm. was very much the same. It was, mm-hmm. okay, we got all of the accounts. We're all over the world. I'm traveling more often than I am spending the night in my own bed. And mm-hmm. I've got the factory dialed to the point where they know what they're doing. I know what they're doing. We know what we're doing. Not a lot more to learn on that front. Mm-hmm. And as we got more and more employees and we became more and more of a, I don't like the word corporation, it lost a little bit of its luster. And mm-hmm. And then when I would come home and I would be in the office, it just lost a little bit of its interest. And then pretty soon I just had a day where the season was over and it was time for something else. And I was ready to go on for new adventures. And that's when I started to think that, okay, maybe this does have a shelf life. Maybe this is something I should think about moving towards the exit with.
That's a great insight. And I have several entrepreneurial friends, they're the same. It's like the 0 to 1 is an exciting, exhilarating journey. But then once it becomes more of an operations and managed people and HR and stuff like that, it's a very different job. And I think there's relatively few people that are really good at both or really enjoy both.
There is a point at which I remember thinking, okay, it's nice that I'm no longer in charge of that department. I now talk to that one person and then that one person talks to that department. But then I realized this is like red tape, because if I don't convey it correctly to that person, then it doesn't cut, the output isn't the same as the input. Or if the middle part doesn't convey it properly, then the output isn't the same as the input. And I started to see that gap of, okay, my idea is red and it comes out a shade of a maroon or even a pink. It's not quite what I was imagining. And it started to get a little clunky. And then eventually it was, okay, we're going to either go for a massive exit or we're going to become a corporation essentially. And I was like, nope, I'm not having it. This is not a suit and tie company, and nor am I a suit and tie type of guy. And I'm not doing it.
Yeah. Oh, great. So did you hire a bank and run a formal process?
A bit, yeah. I had an attorney who, bless him, he did his best, but it was still one of those things that it was hard for people to believe that selling water bottles was a thing and that those numbers could be real and that people are actually buying them. And so there is still a bit of a disconnect and a mental gap and a barrier between, this isn't a real company. It's just a hobby, isn't it? No, we're an international business now and we're doing millions of dollars every year. Yeah, we had to go through that process. And eventually we settled on a number that I do the math and I think, okay, I've been in it this long. And if I exit it this much, well, I've had some pretty good, even though I've made $0 up until that point.
Yeah.
That number takes care of those past years pretty well.
Yeah. And who was the acquirer? Can you share that?
It was a private
equity.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you can share this either, but it was a 9-figure exit. Is that correct?
Yeah. What happened was I exited and then they put in another a substantially large chunk of cash and built up the inventory with that money is really what they did. Yeah. And of course they had the fancy new office and the fancy new chairs and things like that. and then it's a public thing. It went to Helen of Troy for $210 million.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Con Air and OXO and, you know, mm-hmm. corporation.
Yeah. And then what first, congrats and what an amazing story, and thanks for sharing it with us. So what happened after that? Did you ride off in the sunset? And I know you've done other things since. So tell us a little bit about what life after the exit has been like.
Yeah, at first I did. I switched phone numbers. I took off, and I was married to my first wife, who was British. And so we moved to London. We got a house. We had a house in London and a house here in Bend. And we spent time back and forth and just traveling all over the place and paddle boarding, and then eventually yoga. And I really missed business. And I had a lot of people asking me business questions. And I found that I have a true passion for business. I really enjoy helping people and sharing what I can, if I can, and hopefully helping. And so I started the Tumalo Group. And I started helping people find factories in China and work with my Rolodex of friends over there. And I was back and forth quite a bit with that, and taking private clients and groups over to factory field trips, and stayed in the manufacturing world as much as I could. And that kind of died out in 2020, and started up again this January. Actually, was my first trip back to China. And so, yeah, I do consulting, and predominantly in the manufacturing, but also in branding and marketing and business.
Great. So within the last 3-4 years, what kind of changes do you see over in China?
It's been radical. Yeah. It's just been incredible. I started to see the writing on the wall in about 2018. And I didn't know what it was going to be. I wasn't quite sure what was happening or where things were headed. 2019, I could really see that something's about to give, break, or blow up even better and cooler. And then I was on the fourth to last flight out of China in 2020. And I got into Seattle and everything was shut down. And I just had a feeling that I'm not going back anytime soon. And from 2020 to 2021, it wasn't really too different. The factories were still chugging along and plugging out products, and everything seemed to be semi-normal. And then about 2021, 2022, then we had the whole shipping container crisis thing happening, and they're all off Long Beach, and that whole thing kicked in, and I had no idea what was going to happen. And listening to and talking to all my friends in China, COVID days were really difficult for a lot of people. And a lot of people didn't make it through that. And then here in 24, I was there in January for a couple of weeks, and good to see all my friends again and see the state of affairs over there. And very different now.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of competition, right? The cost basis has gone up a lot. We see a lot of customers trying to move from China. People are now fearful of 60% tariffs. So there's been a steady, I think, shift to people are trying to get out of China, but now recently it's almost grown to panic level urgency. Holy crap, we got to get out of there. We got to find an alternative and diversify our supply chain somehow. Do you see the same?
100%. And that to me is very concerning. I've not ever been to any country. I do a lot of research. I'm in this world constant 24/7. I'm in the world of manufacturing. India, Bangladesh, Vietnam, the Philippines, Mexico, Canada, anywhere else. Nobody does it like China. And they have the factories, they have the experience, they have the manpower, they have the knowledge. And I just don't see that anywhere else. And I think that Vietnam was a real sexy alternative, that a lot of people thought that they could just hop over to Vietnam and everything would be great again. On some things, yes, sure, fine. But for the majority of what Americans consume, there's really no other place in my book that can do it like China does. And I wish that we could do it in America. And I've searched high and low, and I've talked to as many factories as I can possibly talk to. And I've tried desperately to bring my clients to new factories here in America and pre-existing old factories in America. The Americans really don't want much to do with startups, and they don't want much to do with low MOQs.
Yeah.
If you don't have a big established brand name, they're not interested. Or if you do something like a vacuum insulation process, can't do that in America. The EPA says no, and there's just no such thing. We shut those factories down, or they've just never existed. And I think that Americans, we've always been taught, and I know most countries have always been taught that there's a bad guy and there's a boogeyman out there. We must be fearful of the boogeyman. And China gets the rap, the bad rap for that. But at the same time, where does everything from Amazon, Walmart, and your local grocery store, all that packaging and all of the, where does most of everything come from? Your local department store? It's China.
Yeah. As you, I mean, you were part of the whole process of China have become what they have become over a period of decades. And like you said, become really good at it. And maybe over 10, 20 years, other markets will, you know, emerge. And but just like you said, most of them are not set up at all to deal, particularly with startups, right? Somebody coming in and they want to place a minimum order quantity purchase order for some kind of consumer product. It's just not going to happen in Mexico, right? And so, yeah, that it's been a really interesting shift. And also, you have friends over there. We have a team in China, really good people. And like you said, often China gets the bad rep, and it used to be quality and then was the government or political tensions. But bottom line, there's a lot of really good people there, good factories, good businesses that can be great partners to us over here.
There's a very big difference between, and I don't think Americans realize that there's a difference between the humans working at the factories and then what the government is doing. And if anybody, I think that Americans now should be able to realize that what our government is doing to us is not who we are. And the things that we see our politicians doing, just because our politicians are doing what they're doing now here in America, that doesn't make us like them. We're not politicians. We're just average, normal people trying to raise our families. That's what they are over there. They're just normal, good people trying to raise their families. What their government's doing, a lot of times it's there's a very big disconnect between the two. And even if they have to take part in that, or they do take part in it, at the end of the day, they're just still trying to raise their family and try to get ahead and trying to live a better day today than they did yesterday. And they have the infrastructure, they have the tools, they have the machines, they have the manpower, they have the knowledge. And to try to go to some place and try to hook up, string together electricity to, and then to eventually build a mud road into a dirt road and a dirt road into a gravel road into a paved road and then put a factory in, it's going to take a minute. And then there's a siesta that happens every day at 3 o'clock and everybody goes home to sleep. And that's not conducive with manufacturing. And China has us beat. And I find a lot of the world beat when it comes to manufacturing.
Yeah. Yeah. There are certainly some interesting developments in other parts of the world, but 100%, it's going to take a while. So we're running out of time here. I'm so grateful for you to be so gracious and spend all this time with us. But tell us a little bit about what's next in your world. What are you excited about the next 6-12 months? And anything that you, our listeners, where can they go learn more about what you're up to?
I do actually have a few things up my sleeve. And I think it's going to take about 6 months to really want to come out and say what the next big thing is. But in the meantime, I have a kind of a piecemealed website, Travis Rossbach, rosbach.com, and Travis Rossbach on LinkedIn. And yeah, I've got a pretty cool thing coming up here soon.
We're excited. We can't wait to learn about it. Any final words of wisdom? A lot of our listeners are product entrepreneurs, people are already selling products, making products, or aspire to become one. If you could share one piece of advice, what would it be?
I would say that if you have a product, you really need to be close to the people who are producing it, and or you need to be close to the people who are helping you produce it, and learn as much as you can, because a lot of the companies are not going to China. They're not going to the factories. And if you're one of those ones that do not go there or do not work closely with those companies, I feel like you're going to fall away. And there are a lot of factories in China that they would love to have you show up and work with you for the next 99 years. And there's a point at which China is even not looking for new people to come in at some point. And so the best you can do is really show up and get to know that culture and those people. So
that's great advice. Travis, again, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. Really enjoy the conversation and can't wait to see what the big reveal is in the next 6 months. And thank you so much.
Sounds good. Thank you. Have a great day. You too. Cheers.
Cheers. All righty, this is Henrik Johansson again. Thank you so much for listening to Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. If you are a successful product entrepreneur or you work in a company that creates new products and you have an interesting story about how you developed your product and brought it to market, and you would like to be on this podcast, please go to Gemba.com and click on podcast and you can fill out an application to be on the podcast. We'd love to hear from you. If you liked this podcast, you enjoyed this interview, and we would greatly appreciate if you would share it on social media. You can just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on socials. If you know anyone that you think would be a great guest, please tag them on social media and let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovator Insights. And would love to see your posts and any suggestions you have for guests. That's how we find most of our guests, from suggestion from other listeners. We're regularly putting out new episodes and new content to make sure you don't miss any episodes. Please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show and it means a ton to me and the team. We really appreciate it. Do you want to know more about Gemba, me, or the podcast? Please go to Gemba.com and click on podcast, or you can follow me on LinkedIn. That's where I do most of my posts. Again, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Have a great day.